Excuse me a second, I have to adjust my recorder here. Sorry. Well, it's nice to see so many of you here. Thanks for being here. We're just fresh into the practice period. And I'm just back from a quick journey to Santa Fe. Kathy and I were in Santa Fe because it was the special 90th birthday celebration for our old teacher, Richard Baker Roshi, and a number of his friends and students from long ago showed up, and it was quite a party with a big special meal at a Japanese restaurant and a breakfast and all that. So he's in actually good shape. He had a stroke, as many of you know, which caused him to have aphasia. So he was always an eloquent speaker, and he still is, but with some gaps and some stuttering difficulties and stuff, but he's okay. He seems to be in good shape, and he has a wonderful successor, a young German woman who was there too, named Nicole Baden. So it was a nice trip, and we got back last night. I appreciated the chance to honor him because you know, Kathy and I were able to, with our young children, spend decades of practicing full time at the Zen Center, largely because of him and his supporting of us. Otherwise, I don't know what would have happened to us if we were rousted out of there. So we're very grateful to him for that. And it's April 1st, springtime for sure. I hope it's nice where you are. Some of my friends in the East told me that the weather's beginning to warm up a little bit. Here at Muir Beach, it's actually a little chilly and kind of cloudy and a little rain today, but not very cold. It's also, that means it's April 1st is April Fool's Day. I don't have any good jokes or any fooling anything other than the usual stuff, but it is April 1st, and also it's Passover this evening. So there'll be a Seder for us right after the Dharma seminar is over, and we've been preparing for that all day long. It's a very special holiday in the Jewish tradition, celebrating liberation, freedom from slavery. And so that's what we're trying to do too, right? We're trying to liberate ourselves from the overarching conceptions and ideas and habits that keep us in bondage. So it's very appropriate that we begin our first meeting with the Passover holiday. So this practice period, we're studying two texts. One is a traditional text that might be maybe not so much fun to read. The Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana. I forget why we chose this one. I think maybe Tracy was reading it a while ago and we said, well, let's do it. Let's do it. So we're doing that. And then the other one is by our teacher, Suzuki Roshi, Becoming Yourself. And I think that the idea is that both of these books are really, they're very different from one another, but they're saying essentially The same thing. The message of both of them is essentially the same. Maybe you could say that the awakening of faith is the theory or the doctrine or the background teaching of Mahayana Buddhism, kind of summarized in one text. It's from the 6th century. While Suzuki Roshi is a modern Japanese Zen master who's not writing a philosophical or learned text. He's not writing at all. In fact, he didn't write any of his books. They were made from oral teachings that he gave, as all of his books were. And he's speaking not in the abstract, but he's speaking very directly to Zen students like us. Maybe some of us attended some of his talks. He's trying to guide us in how to understand and practice Zen as we are in our time. So it's a very different kind of a text, of course. So what I want to do tonight is just introduce the awakening of faith in the Mahayana, say a few words of, background words, and then end with a small section of Suzuki Roshi that I think, when you hear what the thrust of the awakening of faith is, I think the words of Suzuki Roshi will strike you in a different way. Anyway, I hope so. We'll see. And I hope that I don't talk too long so that we'll have some time to really check in with each other about the practice period. Okay, so the awakening of faith in the Mahayana is a very, very important text, specifically and particularly for Far East Asian Buddhism. It's not so important in other places, but it's really important in China and Japan. And since there are no existing Sanskrit versions of the text, a lot of scholars these days think that there never was a Sanskrit version, that actually it was composed in China, and its Chinese authors pretended that it was a text from India, but it wasn't at all. And there's a few texts like that with exactly the same profile, really, really important in Japan, China, and therefore Japan and Korea, but no existing Sanskrit text, and so people think very likely they were composed in China. So the Chinese may well have done stuff like that. There is a back translation of the title in Sanskrit. And in Sanskrit, the title is Mahayana Shrotapada Shastra, which means something like the treatise on the foundation of confidence or faith in the Mahayana. And the words used here, the most important words in the title, faith and Mahayana, probably are a little bit misleading in the way that we would ordinarily hear them from our point of view. When we say faith in English, that word has taken on a huge accretion of meaning from the Christian tradition, 2,000 years, of using that word under the influence of Christianity, in which faith is defined as a knowing or a feeling that is the opposite of reason. It's a kind of enthusiastic overcoming of a feeling of some sort that is sort of flies in the face of reason. That's how we usually understand faith. But that this is a very reasonable and rational treatise. And it proposes to describe a perspective that is solid enough and convincing enough rationally that it would give us confidence to practice and trust the Mahayana Buddhist path. So we would think about what the treatise is saying, and it would give us confidence in the path because it makes sense. And also the word Mahayana in the title doesn't mean really, as our translator Yoshida Hikeda says in his introduction, it doesn't really, or somewhere, maybe not in the introduction, doesn't really mean the Mahayana schools of Buddhism so much as it means the truth, the fundamental great truth of reality itself, almost irrespective of Buddhism per se, but the great truth, the great vehicle for truth about the reality that we're living. So the treatise, in a sense, is not a polemic to convince us to follow the religion of Mahayana Buddhism. It's meant to be a kind of philosophical handbook or summary, which is going to give us a good description of the worldview of the Buddhist path, and then toward the end, showing us different ways to practice that path based on the worldview described in the text. So although the Awakening of Faith, you know, when you see it, it always says it's written by Ashvaghosa, it isn't. Ashvaghosa was a great poet, one of the great Sanskrit poets. He's from the first or second century, and he was actually a dramatic poet. He almost like created the Sanskrit tradition of epic or dramatic poetry, and he was a master of the Kavya style of court poetry. And probably one reason that the text is so authoritative and popular is because it's always been attributed to him, and throughout its history, probably most people believed that he wrote it. And so, you know, they thought, wow, this is by the great Ashvaghosa, so we'll pay attention to it. Ashvaghosa is known in Chinese as Ma Ming, a word that is apparently a literal translation of Ashvaghosa, which in Chinese means the neighing of a horse. And the reason why he has that name, supposedly, is that his poems were so stirring and so moving that when they were recited aloud, even the horses would neigh in response. They were so moved by Ashvaghosa's poetry. The best known work of Ashvaghosa that really did, he really did write, and scholars all attest that he did write it, is called the Buddhacarita, which has been translated into English a number of times. Buddhacarita roughly translates as the Acts of the Buddha. And it is one of the great classics of Sanskrit literature. And it's an epic in verse that tells the story of Buddha's birth and his enlightenment. And that's the poem that I used many years ago when I composed the Buddha's birthday pageant that we used to do it at every spring at Gringotts. Maybe some of you remember that. People would come from all around, lots of children, and would have this amazing pageant with giant masks and music and everything. Because Ashvaghosa, his poem is the source of a lot of the legends about the birth of the Buddha. Specifically, the birth of the Buddha is really stirringly depicted in that poem. So they say that the Awakening of Faith was first translated into Chinese in 550 by Paramartha, who was an historical figure, a West Indian monk, who translated a lot of stuff from Sanskrit into Chinese. But, like I say, whether that's true, nobody really knows, because it could have been composed originally by Paramartha or somebody else. Never in India, we don't know. So we don't really know who the author of the text is, or even whether there is an author, the way we would understand authorship today, which is kind of a recent idea, you know, the idea that a text would have an author. And I always, you know, imagine that all writing in its earliest versions, way back in time, all writing was, I think, religious in nature, and nobody thought they were writing stuff out of their own heads. Nobody thought they were explaining their own individual point of view, but they were channeling some sort of sense of religious enactment, religious union. So the text was coming to them, not created by them, but coming to them from the gods or from the Buddhas. And maybe they were composing in groups, orally, probably, and then reciting as a ritual the text that they had composed together, and only much later were these texts written down. Probably not the case particularly with this text, but at that time, the idea that there were not authors per se would have been commonplace. None of the sutras have any authors. They're all attributed to the Buddha, of course. Thus have I heard the Buddha said at one time. But I think that a lot of people produce those words besides the Buddha, that we know. And those of you who write, I think, can understand what I'm talking about, since the appearance of words on a page that come at the speed of thought, or maybe without any thought, that is a very magical procedure, and not one's own. In actual fact, as anybody who has written much and thought about this knows. All this just to say that we don't know who composed The Awakening of Faith or what person or persons, and we don't know exactly when, although we do know that it first appeared around that time. The thing that's so great about The Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana is it's short, and that's a big deal. That's like very important. Hakata's translation, exclusive of footnotes and introductions and all these other things, in indices or whatever else he has. But the actual text itself, which even I think includes some little commentaries embedded in the text by him, the whole text is only 83 pages long. And the Mahayana sutras, and there are so many of them, way, way more than we even know about in the West, are characterized by their excessive length. In fact, that's one of the terms used to describe Mahayana sutras, Vaipulya sutras, extended sutras, because they're really, really long. The early Buddhist literature mostly was short texts. So the Mahayana sutras are really, really long. Some of them run into thousands of pages, with lots of poetic scene setting, tons of repetition, and long involved discourses on dharma, on doctrine sometimes. And there are a lot of different Mahayana doctrines, different from one another. So there's the emptiness teachings, lots of emptiness sutras. There's the mind-only teachings. There's the Abhatamsaka Sutra teachings, or the Huayan teachings as they became known in China. There are the Buddha nature teachings, the Tathagatagarbha teachings. And every one of these teachings is, developed at tremendous length in Mahayana sutras. And every one of these teachings is different from every other one, although they're not at all contradictory. And I think you can feel how they're connected and mutually reinforcing. So they're not exactly, refuting one another, but they are different. So it's a little bit confusing. And especially given the length of these sutras, it can be quite dizzying. And, while these texts were possibly created organically out of the Indian context, they were coming to China, right? Sometimes in large batches, and being translated in large translation bureaus. And the Chinese people were probably bewildered by the whole thing. And they were made all kinds of efforts to try to make sense of it. And when you think about the Chinese already had a very developed literary and spiritual literature culture before Buddhism came to China. And when you think about their ancient texts, the Tao Te Ching, the Analects of Confucius, these are short texts. They're pretty short. Maybe, I don't know how many pages, but not very many, like maybe around 100. So, didn't they want a short treatise, right, that would summarize all the Mahayana doctrines. That was going to be really popular in China, and probably in a way, some kind of a necessity. So that's why the Awakening of Faith exists. It is that. It is has been for China that treatise that would give you a sense of the entire Mahayana. But of all the teachings included, the main thrust of the Awakening of Faith seems to be two of these teachings that I mentioned, the Tathagatagarbha teachings, Buddha nature teachings. Tathagatagarbha means the womb or the matrix of the Tathagata, the Buddha, the such, the one, the suchness. So that's one of the main teachings of the Awakening of Faith. And the other one is the mind-only teachings. And these two teachings, as much as anything, are foundational for Zen. Other teachings are included in Zen, but these are really important foundations for Zen. And that these teachings are saying, more or less, and yeah, I'm giving you a couple of sentences on something that's many pages, but they're saying more or less, reality is profound, all-inclusive at every point, and reality itself is Buddha. And given that, you are Buddha. We are Buddha. All sentient beings are Buddhas by nature. And so we must realize our nature by behaving as Buddhas, by practicing, not so that we can straighten ourselves out and overcome something within us, but so that we can express our true nature. And that is, our true nature is to be all of reality, to be all-inclusive reality. And because of that, the consequence of this would be a kind of profound compassion that would be far more than all our ideas of compassion, because all our ideas of compassion assume an other that we would care for. But in this version of reality, there is no other. So compassion or love is the nature of reality itself. Anyway, something like that is what these two teachings are saying, and that, I think that's foundational to Zen, and we'll hear it as we read Suzuki Roshi all the time. So that's the good news about this text. It's short, and its doctrines are inspiring and important for us. The bad news is the same thing, that because it's so short, it leaves a lot unexplained. And therefore, it's so pithy, it's a little hard to read. And it might be like a lot of texts that it's short because the author didn't expect anybody to really be able to understand it, because it was kind of like lecture notes. So you weren't supposed to be able to understand it. It was just for the purpose of teachers to go through it and provide, the extended explanations that might be necessary to understand it. So that means that the text mentions big topics but doesn't explain them, figuring that they'll be explained later. Therefore, you can imagine there are a lot of commentaries to the Awakening of Faith. Professor Ikeda tells us there are 170 commentaries that are well known. Probably there's a lot more that are not well known. I don't know, but I never heard of any of these commentaries having been translated into English, but maybe they have been. Maybe they're sitting in some library somewhere as a PhD thesis. I wouldn't be surprised. But in general, I don't know about any of them, and most of us don't know about any of them. So that puts us at a distinct disadvantage when we're reading this text. And then that brings up another point, which is, you know, very obvious, but we don't necessarily talk about this so much, and that is that we are studying this text without the whole of its context, the whole world in which it was produced, let alone the literature out of which it arose. So it's interesting. I mean, Western Buddhism has been going now for quite a while. I mean, not very long in terms of Buddhist history, but long enough, you know, maybe you could say, maybe it's been going for more than 100 years, seriously. And now there's a Western Buddhist context. There's a, I would say there's a Western version of Buddhism, which is built on a selection of the vast amount of Buddhist texts, probably ones that were deemed to be the most important and foundational. And these texts now, by now, have been translated many, many times and commented on by Western teachers. And so there's a literature by Western teachers about this relatively small selection of texts. So, and we're very engaged with all that, right? We have plenty to study. I mean, we've been studying for 25 years at Every Day Zen, and another 25 years before that at Zen Center. And we haven't been wanting for things to study, but what we're studying is actually a tiny little part of the vastness of Buddhist literature, most of which remains untranslated and probably will never be translated. So it's almost like we have this alternative view of a tradition that's very different from how it existed in its original context. So, although the awakening of faith is very short, this big context that we don't have is probably very broad. So when we're reading it, you know, we're reading it in a very different circumstances than it would have been read over many centuries in China. And so I'm saying this as a kind of background thought to let us be modest, you know, in our undertaking this text, and not try to think that we're supposed to be able to master it and understand it. It may not, in many places, make enough sense to us to do us any good. We'll see. Maybe it will. But I hope that we can learn something from it without getting too snarled up in it. One of the ways that I notice that people get snarled up in texts is by taking the terms that they use too seriously. So the awakening of faith will use the word Buddha nature, suchness, a whole raft of Mahayana Buddhist terminology. But I think we shouldn't really worry that much about stuff like this, because, you know, I think that there are lots of different definitions of these terms. There isn't a definition, and there's all kinds of shades of definition. And anyway, what are those things but just words that people made up for the purpose of trying to help us practice? So let's not lose sight of that. The meaning of these terms, in actual fact, is in our feeling for our lives and how we live them. That's what these terms actually mean. And our purpose in studying anything is always to make it our own, to confirm the text for ourselves. Sometimes I say, you know, all of the Dharma is your autobiography. It's your life, your inner life. And so if you understand it in any other way, as an abstraction outside of yourself, you're missing what it's really about. It's really about you. And all the other stuff about you that you think of is less about you, actually, than the Dharma is. But in relation to this question of the terms and what they mean, this is an interesting paragraph from Hikeda's introduction. What may be baffling to the reader of the translation is the abundant use of underdefined, I like that word, underdefined, and sometimes undefined terms that may be regarded as belonging to the vocabulary of theology, epistemology, psychology, or even biology. And the difficulty results basically from the monistic outlook of the text. That's monistic. monistic, not monastic, but monistic, meaning the idea of the oneness of reality, although that's not actually correct either exactly, but good enough, as well as in part from the author's attitude toward his work. The entire text, in a sense, and this is, I'm still going on with Hecate here, is an outline that necessarily requires further elucidation and exegesis, which I said before. The intent of the author to present his outline as succinctly as possible has resulted in insufficient definition of the terms used in underdeveloped argument. Furthermore, the author has made an attempt to systematize all phases of Mahayana teaching and practice under the simplest, most fundamental, yet universal formulas, with the use of various religious, philosophical, and psychological terms that represent many different trends in the Mahayana teaching of his time. The best attitude to take when reading the text is perhaps to try to understand the symbolic significance of the terms in their context and the intention of the argument, putting aside as much as possible the most commonly accepted definitions of these terms. And I've noticed that when I read The Awakening of Faith, it uses terms that I've heard before, but it seems to use them in slightly different ways, which in a way makes it a little more kind of discordant. But the basic teachings are clear enough: Buddha nature, the oneness of reality, which is awakened from the start, so everything is included in it. Even the non-awakened is included in the awakened reality. And those ideas, as I said, are fundamental to Chinese Buddhism and to Zen, and they're also fundamental to Dogen. When you think about the study that we were doing last month when we read Refrain from Unwholesome Action by Dogen, isn't what he's saying there that being itself, existence itself, is awakening? Awakening is not a state of existence. Awakening is existence itself. And that's why he says even unwholesome action is awakening. That's what he says in that text. Even though we're practicing refraining from unwholesome action is awakening itself. That's what he says in that text. So you can see that relationship of that to the main ideas of the Awakening of Faith. It also accounts for the fact that Buddhism is notably generous in its view of immoral and amoral activity. It's clear that, you know, we are doing good and not doing bad. But when it comes to bad having been done, there's a very generous and forgiving attitude because bad having been done is also awakening. So, you know, there's no prophetic tradition in Buddhism for that reason. So, let's see, one more thought. Before we read the invocation of the text, and that is Hakata does a pretty good job in his introduction of talking about Yogacara concept of mind, which is really important foundation for the text. Mind only, sometimes it's called, or one mind. That's the all-inclusive reality that I'm speaking about. Sometimes they call it suchness, Tathagata, Dharmakaya. Lots of different words. Mind doesn't mean mental. It doesn't mean consciousness. Mind, maybe with a capital M, includes what we call mind and matter, includes both. Mind connotes reality and engagement with being, because reality is a bigger idea than being, because reality includes non-being, which is a little misleading, because in Buddhism, being itself includes non-being. Birth and death is one phenomenon. Anyway, the main issue of the text, this is the crux of it, is how mind with a capital M as absolute, somehow expresses itself as mind with a small m, as this relative world of me and you and all of our troubles. How is it that mind expresses itself in that way? And so that dialectic is really the main point of the text. And it's something that we're talking about all the time in practice. And maybe it's the only issue that there is in practice. We are Buddha, and Buddha is us. All of birth and death, and Buddha is right here in every moment of our being alive. How come we miss that? How do we live that? How do we come to understand it? I think that's pretty much Suzuki Roshi's idea of becoming yourself. When he says become yourself, he's not saying perfect your personality. He's not saying like eliminate your personality, but he's not saying develop your personality. I think what he means by becoming yourself is ground your personality in the absolute. At every point, ground who you are in Buddha nature, which is your own true nature. That's what he means by becoming yourself. So in a way, you know, this is a very simple-minded idea. It's not very complicated. Putting it into practice in our lives so that this is the way we live, it's not complicated either, but it takes a lifetime of devotion. Buddha nature is a word that indicates that we are phenomenal beings who come and go quickly in this phenomenal world. And at the same time, we are, each one of us, through and through, absolute Buddha beings who never came, and so we can't ever go. So here's the invocation, and then I'll stop talking about this after that. I'll just read you, I'll quote you the invocation as translated by Hikeda. I take refuge in the Buddha, the great, compassionate one, the savior of the world, omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient, of most excellent deeds in all the 10 directions. I take refuge in the Dharma, the manifestation of his essence, the reality, the sea of suchness, the boundless storehouse of excellencies. And in the Sangha, whose members truly devote themselves to the practice. May all sentient beings be made to discard their doubts, cast aside their evil attachments, and give rise to the correct faith in the Mahayana, that the lineage of the Buddhas may not be cut off. So this invocation tells you that despite the philosophical nature of the text, it's a deeply religious text whose intention is to help us out with practice. And it's dedicated to and channeled from the Buddha Dharma and Sangha. And the author ends the invocation by praying that sentient beings who are always so confused and troubled will have confidence in the truth of the Mahayana, which will save us from our confusion and draw us to the Buddha way, and that it will continue into the future. I hope so too. I hope that the Buddha way will continue into the future, long, long after everybody here is gone. I hope so. Anyway, now I'm going to read you a short bit from Becoming Yourself by Suzuki Roshi, and see if you can hear in this passage echoes of what I've been talking about. I hope I expressed it clearly enough so you got an idea. And this is, I'm quoting from page 87 in the text, Small Mind and Buddha Mind. I won't quote all of it, but a lot of it. Small mind and Buddha mind. And remember, keep in mind, especially the part about the absolute and the relative, our absolute Buddha self and our relative phenomenal self, and how those two things are not two things at all. Those are two different words, but they're one reality. That's what the word monism that Hikeda uses means. So see if you can hear that in Suzuki Roshi. Whatever you do can be practice. Drinking tea, eating, sleeping, walking, or sitting down. But how you understand these things is very important. If you miss the point, even if it looks like you are doing proper practice, it doesn't work. This is very important. You should see whether you are doing the activity for yourself, for the sake of the truth, for the sake of Buddha, or for the sake of others. If there are many fruits in a basket, my way is to eat the worst fruit first. Why eat the best one first? When you eat the best one first, you discriminate the best one from the not so good ones, and you put the idea of yourself first. If only one person is eating fruit, that will not be a problem. But if many people are eating from the same basket, you will be in trouble. This is Kathy and I, a big problem that we have. I say, you eat the good one. No, you eat the good one. No, you eat the good one. You should eat the good one. We get in fights over this, you know. It's true. You eat the bigger piece. No, you have the bigger piece. But if many people are eating from the same basket, you will be in trouble. If you eat the worst one first, there is no problem, even if you eat with many people. This attitude of eating the worst one is non-discrimination. You may say it is a kind of discrimination, but it is non-discrimination since a self-centered attitude is not involved. So this is really interesting because, you know, when we talk about the Shin Shin Ming, the famous koan, the great way is not difficult, just avoid picking and choosing. And then we get very confused. How can you avoid picking and choosing? You're always picking and choosing. Well, here Suzuki Roshi says, you're not picking and choosing if you pick and choose without a self-centered attitude. So that's actually a major comment by Suzuki Roshi on that teaching. I'll try to remember that and write it down so I don't forget next time. In your everyday practice, do you develop your idea of yourself or do you develop Buddha mind? We should always put the Buddha mind first and the self next. So don't ignore the self, just don't put it first. We should always follow Buddha mind. To follow Buddha mind, it is necessary to realize what Buddha mind is. The way to realize Buddha mind is Zazen practice, which I'm pretty sure is not mentioned. Well, yes, that's not right. Meditation is mentioned in the Awakening of Faith, but not exactly in the sense of Zazen, as Dogen means it. To realize the way to realize Buddha mind is Zazen practice. Through Zazen practice, you will intuitively know what Buddha mind is because your selfish ideas or your smaller self, your small self will become smaller. So beware, everybody, if you don't want your small self to become smaller, don't do Zazen. It will not help you. By continuing Zazen practice, you will get more and more accustomed to this intuitive knowledge of Buddha mind. The more you continue to practice, the smaller your small self becomes. Big self will take over your small self. Well, I think those of us who have been doing Zazen for a while can attest to the truth of that. Not to say that your small self slinks away forever and ever, but it just becomes less of a bully than it used to be. The practice which is self-centered is not Buddhist practice. Buddhist practice is to reduce our self-centeredness and to develop Buddha mind. The point of practice is to put the first principle first and the second principle next. To put the big self first and the small self next. It is to try to extend the big self always. Now I'm skipping a bunch and I'm going over to the other facing page 89. We practice Zazen and the other activities of Zen training in order to digest the knowledge of our Zazen experience, to completely extend our realization to our everyday life. The way we speak, the way we treat things, the way we treat people. The rules of Zen practice are set up to help you to extend the Buddhist way in your everyday life, to extend your realization to your everyday activity through the way you eat and the way you recite sutras. Even though you feel it is difficult, You will digest it more and more, and eventually what you do will help people, even though you are not trying to help people. When you come to this point, there is no Buddha. There is no layperson. There is no priest. There is no teaching. Because you have it, in other words, you are it, nothing special exists. You are actually always one with people, one with your friend, one with Buddha. Sometimes a Zen master may say, no Buddha, kill Buddha. What does that mean? It means to be completely one with Buddha. You don't need Buddha anymore because you yourself are Buddha. And you come to this through your practice. And it's a process. So there's a lot of people here tonight, and I really appreciate that. And I know that as the practice period goes on, it's very likely that there'll be less of you. It sort of happens, you know? But I hope not, because this is what happens when you practice. When you practice, you don't get necessarily learn anything at all. Like, I wanted to learn something, and this is too boring. I'm not learning anything. But it's not like that. The process of practice makes you realize these things, and it's subtle. You know, it's not a big thing. If it were a big thing, you'd wear it out really fast. So I hope that everybody here will stick it out for this practice period, even if it seems dumb and you get tired of it and there's more interesting things to do and more important things to do. I have no doubt there are many more important things to do, but those important things, you know, won't have this impact. But a practice period, if you're faithful to it, will really make a big difference. So anyway, that's what I wanted to say to you tonight to open our practice period. And thank you very much for listening. I really do appreciate it. I'm a lucky person to have so many really intelligent and wonderful people who are willing to sit still and listen to me for such a long time. Thank you so much. So now you should talk. And Leni is our host tonight, and she's going to put you in groups of three. And I don't think that you can do whatever you want to do. We're really, what this is checking in with one another for our first longer conversation of the practice period. And so I'm not so interested in this teaching per se and what you think it means, but just how are you, where are you at and how are you feeling now that we begin this practice period? We started on Saturday. It was a really wonderful day. I thought I really enjoyed it. I hope you guys did too online and those of you who were there. So now we're launched. How are you feeling? What's in your heart? What are you looking forward to? What are you trying to do? What are your intentions? What are your issues? Listen to each other. Let's bear witness to each other. We're here to not give anybody any advice, as I said the other day, but just to listen to one another. And also to speak. Somehow, when you say, you know, this is how it is for me, it's unbelievable how much that helps another person, even when their issues are very different. Somehow hearing you really helps them. So don't give advice, but listen to one another. And I think that we can, go for, give each person 5 minutes, five, five, and five in groups of three. And then we'll have a few more minutes other things, you know, some conversation after the 15 minutes is over. So maybe about 20 minutes in the groups, Leni, if we could do that. And then it takes a minute to get in and a minute to get out. But about 20 minutes in the group should give us enough time for all of us talking together. And I see Linda Tong over there. Hi, Linda. I haven't seen you in a long time from Vancouver. Yeah, it must be 20 years.